What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you, of course, for subscribing, downloading, rating. We appreciate all of those things because it gives us some sense of self-worth, if nothing else. If you'd like to get in contact with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. Fascinating show for you this week because we're going to be speaking to the researchers behind an experiment that allowed scientists to ask people who were dreaming questions and get answers back. It changes everything we know about dreaming. That's up after our week's science news. Joining us on Skype is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and double Dr. Laura Dungan. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Shane, has to do with my kryptonite, electricity.
Oh yeah, I forgot that. Yeah.
I just don't get it. I just will never get electricity. Anyway, well, this sounds even more I don't get it-y.
Yeah, this one's going to blow your mind, Jonathan. Imagine electricity transmission without the need for wires, right? So like instead of having all the pylons and the high tension cables running around the country to get electricity from points A to B, C and D, E, etc. Imagine having no wires. And that's what a New Zealand company is trying to do at the moment. And they're building on work that was done famously by Nikola Tesla back in the early 1900s. And he has an awful lot of credibility in the electricity world.
He does. He does indeed.
He does. Yeah. So he's associated with alternating current, which is a big one. And he also was very interested in how to transmit electricity because this was a really key thing. There was no infrastructure back then. So they were generating power. How were they going to get it to people's houses? And so he failed, unfortunately, with the wireless transmission, as we all know. And part of the reason was he couldn't get it that far. And there was no way to regulate who was going to take it. So it was easy to steal. And the New Zealand
like
company...
Radio. Like you can just steal like, radio yeah. from the air and no one can know that you're listening.
Well, fortunately, no one is listening to this. So what they're doing in New Zealand is they're building on Tesla's work and they have a couple of tricks up their sleeves to improve on his failure. The first one is that they're using a very narrow form of microwaves to transmit the electricity. So they convert electricity into electromagnetic radiation, which is light, light that's in the form of microwave radiation. And then they transmit that in a very narrow beam from point A to B.
Sounds like laser beams. Sounds dangerous.
Well, it kind of is because they have to wrap it in a laser curtain. Because what happens is if this beam of microwaves passes through a person or an animal, it can heat them up. Much like it would be if you were in a microwave. And that's not good, right? So like you don't need Lara as a doctor to tell you that. So what they do is they have feedback loops in the beam. And if you break the laser curtain, it shuts off the power transmission. Okay. And it does so instantly because it's traveling at the speed of light. So that's one thing.
Another issue. How far does it go?
Well, this is the big thing. It doesn't go very far at the moment. So they have to put in relays to kind of keep the transmission kind of going. So they're described as lenses in order to kind of move on the power from point A to point B to point C, etc. So there is an early stage here, but they're not the only company that are doing this. And you never know, maybe for rural transmission or when we're generating power with wind turbines that are distributed across the country, this sort of stuff could solve a big problem for us, which is movement of power to where it's needed from where it's generated.
Look, obviously birds turning your electricity off all the time is not ideal. But if we're looking at homes that have some sort of storage facility, and this is coming from solar, very exciting to imagine a landscape without flipping pylons and electrical wires. But yeah, I mean, I presume that is very different to the sort of electronic transmission that happens when we wirelessly charge our phones.
It is different. So one is kind of near field, and that
uses that's fine. If that is different, is fine. My brain is full. We're going to get to our second story, Lara, which has to do with self-regulation and cuttlefish.
Oh, God, I never know what Shane's talking about, which means he's a really good science communicator. Yes, absolutely. This is about cuttlefish. So cuttlefish are squid-like creatures. They have eight arms and they can change color. They're pretty well known because they're used in an awful lot of experiments. And they're very intelligent. So what they've just shown in this new paper that was published in the Proceedings of the Royal Academy is that they have the ability to have self-control or delayed gratification. There's a very famous test. We've spoken about it on the show before, and my brother nearly disowned me because I said that he would fail it on the radio. The Stanford marshmallow test, where you give a child one marshmallow and you tell them if they don't eat it, then in 5 minutes' time, they can have a second marshmallow. So it's a way for children to prove that they do or don't have the ability to delay gratification.
Which, by the way, just quick caveat, there's questions over the whole
huge questions. Absolutely. Look, huge questions, definitely. But they modified this because, funny enough, dropping marshmallows into a tank with cuttlefish isn't the most practical way to assess them. So they put three different chambers in with these cuttlefish and they trained them. Each of the chambers had a visual cue on it, so a symbol. And one of the chambers was the kind of chamber that as soon as they dropped the food in, the little door would come up and they could have the food instantly. The second chamber, the door would come up, but there was a delay. And in the third chamber, the door would come up, but the food was always blocked by clear plastic. So the cuttlefish learned the one that would give them the instant food, the one that would give them the delayed food, and the one that they'd just never get, the unobtainable food. So then they took these same cuttlefish and they put them in a different chamber with the immediate and with the delayed food, but they put food they didn't like as much into the immediate food chamber. So when they open that up, you would expect that that any animal would just go and eat it, this second preference food. But what they found was that the cuttlefish didn't. They actually waited for the delayed chamber to open with the food that they really, really liked in it. And they were able to wait anywhere from about 50 up to 130 seconds, which is over 2 minutes. So it's extremely interesting. A lot of the reason why people believe that humans or chimps or parrots or crows do delay gratification is for reasons such as we are using tools and, you know, it's better to get a good tool to catch your food, or we have loved ones, so we would rather our mate eat food. But none of these things apply to cuttlefish. So it's hard to know exactly why they have the ability to delay gratification. And they think it's probably an efficiency thing. So if you get the better food, you can maximize the efficiency and the calories that you can gain from it. But very fascinating that they have the cerebral ability to know, don't eat that food, better food is coming.
Have they done a test to see the abundance of psychopaths in testing, psychological testing and testing of animals? And I don't mean this in necessarily, this isn't,
so
this
like
isn't
in the
one
people
the
who are doing
one,
the testing,
like, who sits down and goes, and what, we'll give them a little bit of food they like, and then we'll give them food that they look like but they can't touch. Like, it just seems so it seems so perfect a fit for, you know,
it does,
Dick Dastardly's of the science world. Anyway, cuttlefish can self-regulate. Our third story, Shane, has to do with geoengineering. And people don't like it, but it may be our last hope.
Yeah, so the question is, if climate change is going to kill us all, should we fiddle with the atmosphere in order to slow it down? That's the premise here with geoengineering. And it's very controversial. And so in Sweden, quite soon, they're going to send a balloon up into the atmosphere. And this is a test flight for what it might do in the future, which would be to release calcium carbonate dust. And that dust could reflect some of the sunlight from the atmosphere and prevent further warming. Now, that's very controversial, to have a kind of an extra step to let us away with not changing the way we live and reduce the amount of carbon dioxide and methane that we're emitting. There's also a worry that you could have something called termination shock, so that if you stop putting dust up there for some reason, that you'd have a very sharp rise in warming because you would have continued to emit carbon dioxide in the meantime. So environmentalists have mixed feelings on this because it does offer a short-term fix. However, it doesn't really, it's like giving people medication for depression, right? It can help, but you're not really getting at the causes, right? So it is a tricky issue, an ethical issue. Interestingly, China and India also have a kind of geoengineering schemes in the pipeline. So Sweden's not the only one.
Yeah, it is sort of a, you know, it's sort of one of those things that you may end up have to doing, but the idea of even researching it is abhorrent to some people. But at the end of the day, at some stage, we might have to go panic buttons, worst case scenario, let's release the balloons. And if we haven't got the balloons or know what the balloons are supposed to do, then there's no balloons. Final story. I've summed it up quite nicely there, I think. Our final story has to do with the end of a Chinese experiment where this has happened a number of times across science. Poor volunteers were exposed to a fake space environment.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's called Lunar Palace One, and it's on the grounds of the Beihang University in Beijing in China. And they have now had two sets of four students go for a combined 370 days in this essentially biosphere. So it's a sealed, essentially three sealed containers that have little bridges between them. Two are big rooms for growing plants under LED lights. And the third container is a living space of about 450 square feet with four little living chambers in it, or sleeping chambers, and a common room for them as well. And it's a fascinating way to assess what China would like to do, which is put a station on the icy part of the South Pole of the moon and have it be self-contained. What they found was over these 370 days, that the longest stint was four students staying in for 200 days. So they rotated these students. And what they found was that they only had to get 2% of the materials that they needed in total from the outside world. So that was seeds, for instance, because obviously where else are the plants going to come from? Toilet paper and cleaning products. Otherwise, they were able to be self-sustained. So they used LED lights to grow the plants. The plants provided oxygen. Condensation came off the plants, which they were able to drink. Waste water was used to give water to the plants. The human feces and also the waste plant material was used then to grow the plants. They grew mushrooms, which fed mealworms, which were mushed up into a protein-rich bread. So there was every little innovation you could possibly think of. And to the point that they did, they survived for now a combined total of just over a year in this space-like environment.
Wow. And they've gone through pretty much all of COVID in this. I mean, like, we think we're bad with our 5K limits. That sounds like a horrific experience, but a great time to do it because everyone else is doing the same thing.
Yeah, what else were they doing in the meantime? And they didn't get COVID. So
obviously on the moon you could just poo outside, so that's, we would need the toilet paper. I suppose you need to clean yourself, so you think about
what on earth do you think toilet paper is for?
Well, no, but I suppose I was thinking, yeah, no, you're right. Could you not use a jet of air or something? I don't know. I'm sure they'd
figure
something.
You could use a jet of water, but I think the water was probably more valuable to them than the toilet paper was.
See,
but also you can bring products to this moon base. You know, you can have things from the outside world. So, you know, why not bring toilet paper?
How are they doing psychologically? Does it say anything about that? Probably doesn't.
It doesn't mention that. Nobody cares
alive
how these
and
poor
well.
People are doing. Yeah.
Under very strict definitions of what well
exactly
means.
They are breathing.
Dr. Lara Dungan, Dr. Schoenberger from UCD, thanks as always. Now, we've known that some dreamers, called lucid dreamers, are able to communicate with people in the real world for a while now. But is it possible to communicate in and have a conversation with people as they inhabit their own dream world? What doors could that open? Well, Karen Conkley is a PhD student at Northwestern University, and her paper claims to have done just that. Karen, you're welcome to the program. I'm absolutely fascinated by this. Let's start off with a simple definition. What exactly is a lucid dreamer, Karen?
Yeah, so a lucid dream is when you're inside a dream and you realize that you're dreaming. if you think of a dream that you had before, it might seem like a memory to you. You know, you're not really in it. But when you become lucid in a dream, you're present. And suddenly your surroundings are just, you know, it feels like you're awake, kind of like you're in that environment right then. And so somebody described it recently, like you can feel drunk in a lucid dream, like you're there, but you're not all the way there. And so as you become more lucid, more aware that you're dreaming, you can also do things intentionally. You can control the dream. And so, for instance, if you look somewhere in a dream, that can correspond with where your eyes are looking in your body, and that can be measured. So that's one way that lucid dreamers have communicated outside of dreams, and that's been studied since the 80s.
And so someone outside can actually see this movement, and then you can sort of see that they're trying to say something to you. So they could say something like, I'm dreaming in Morse code, or something along those lines.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's how the dreamers communicated out to us. And that's been done before. But then what we kind of added on was like, well, how much could they hear of what we just say to them while they're sleeping? So we just presented like these math problems very softly while they were in a lucid dream, like 8 - 6, 5 - 3. And then the dreamer, we asked like, look left, right once for each number in your response. And several dreamers were able to correctly answer math problems while they were asleep. And that was just the US team, but then in kind of different variations, it got replicated within those three other countries as well.
When people hear this, they might say, oh, you know, that's not communicating. This could be just random chance, their eyes moving around. How do you count for that?
Yeah, so it's nice if you can see a picture. But so when somebody's in rapid eye movement sleep, there's a burst of eye movements and their eyes will kind of move around. But it's almost never the case that they're, you know, there was one example from the 50s where somebody was dreaming of watching a ping pong match and then their eyes were looking dramatically left, right, over and over again. But that almost never happens. So like these eye signals, because your eyes are, it's like, we ask people look all the way to your left ear, all the way to your right ear. And so do that two times. And kind of the largeness of those eye movements and also the even spacing of them stands out from regular eye movements.
It doesn't look like a random movement. It looks like a conscious, thoughtful movement to answer the question.
Right. And in addition to that, we had these like blind judges who didn't know what questions were asked go in and look at all the eye movements and say like, okay, this one was a signal. What was the signal? And we kind of use that rather than our own interpretations of what the signals were to confirm that it wasn't just us.
So yours was one study. There are three other studies. I want you to tell me about the methodology of those, and then we'll talk about the experience of some of these dreamers, because how they perceived your voice is fascinating.
Yeah. So for the three other countries, so the Dutch team did a method very similar to ours. They recruited people who weren't necessarily lucid dreamers and trained them to lucid dream and asked math problems the same way. And then there was also a French team. And so they had one subject who had narcolepsy, which is a sleep disorder where you can kind of rapidly enter REM sleep. And people with narcolepsy are more likely to have lucid dreams. And so they're participant was a super skilled lucid dreamer. And so they gave him a whole bunch of tasks, not just, they didn't ask him math problems, but they asked yes or no questions. So they were like, do you speak Spanish? And then he answered, you know, one signal for yes, one signal for no. They also did like a task where they tapped him on the hand and he had to say how many times they tapped him on the hand. They did like, did you hear a high tone or a low tone? And so their dreamer, instead of answering with eye movements, he answered by twitching his face. So like when you're in a dream, most of your muscles are paralyzed, but you can still twitch. And so to say yes, he would like furrow his brow or like kind of smile. And then they could monitor that while he was still asleep. So that was the French team. And then the German team, what they did was they used Morse code. So they recruited experienced lucid dreamers far and wide from the internet. And then they trained them, okay, how do you learn Morse code while you're awake? They wanted them to learn it so well they could do it in their sleep. And then they came to the sleep lab overnight and he asked them math problems in Morse code using flashing lights or beeping sounds, and they decoded it in their dreams.
Wow. And what's, I suppose, much more convincing about that data is the fact that there are four different countries, four different research teams, but also four different methodologies of communicating and getting results back.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And we all did it separately and then found each other afterwards.
So talk to me about these lucid dreamers, these people who are aware they are in a dream and are able to control their actions, something that I'm so jealous of as someone who has often had dreams where I wish I could influence what was happening. Talk to me about them, these lucid dreamers. What did they perceive when they hear this voice? Did they imagine the researcher was speaking to them? Do they sort of see themselves in the lab, or what was their experience?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So there are some, you know, there's kind of a literature leading up to it on like dream incorporation of sound. So like you might have like heard an alarm clock in your dream, or like had some sound incorporated. And one thing we were kind of worried about was like, what if we ask them a question and they hear something totally different and they can't answer? Like if we ask, you know, 1 + 2 and they answer, they hear like, I am you, or, you know, something that like isn't distorted. But actually dreamers were in general able to just hear what we said. And so that was one thing that was surprising to us. So sometimes they heard it, you know, as they just heard it coming from outside the dream, although they were still in the dream, but other times it got incorporated in really interesting ways. So like on the French team, their participant was dreaming of being at a party and they heard God talking to them like from somewhere, and it were like a narrator of a movie or something. And they were like, okay, like, I guess that's it. They answered it like that. Or in
so,
the German-
so in that case, when a lucid dreamer is in their dream and then they suddenly hear this disembodied voice asking questions, do they then go, oh, that's the scientist? Or do they just go, well, God's talking, I better answer. What did they say?
I think that in order for somebody to answer, they have to like do the signal. And so if they don't have the wherewithal to remember that they're in an experiment, they probably wouldn't give an answer that we could identify.
Right, they would have just spoke, yeah.
Yeah, one of my participants, so we were asking the math problems, right? And I asked this guy all these math problems, and he woke up and he hadn't answered any of them. And he reported a dream that he was in another psychology experiment where he had to listen to all these math problems. And so like, in that case, he didn't remember he was in our experiment, so he didn't answer the math problems, but he did hear them in the context of this other dream.
Right, so that's quite inception-y, isn't it?
Yes. And there was another participant who had a dream. She was in math class, and the teacher was talking, and she like saw the problems being written on the whiteboard.
Oh my God! I mean, that is really freaky. So you...
I know. I was like, that's amazing that, you know, the problems or the situation could like bias her dream to be about math class.
So you were standing outside someone who was dreaming, you would ask them math questions, and then a teacher or something put them up on the board for that person to answer. Like, this opens some really interesting realms of possibilities, right? I mean, yeah. What is the first thing that you think of when you realize that we can now communicate into people while they're dreaming?
Yeah, well, I, you know, one kind of barrier to dream research is how difficult it is to like manipulate dreams systematically. So like, because it's really hard to have somebody dream about a specific thing, it's hard to say like what dreaming about something does, because there's all these variables leading up to the dream, and then there's all the variables after the dream. And so you can't really like, so one thing that we're hoping is that it could help like lucid dreaming studies in general. Like if a dreamer forgets what they want to do, but then you could communicate with them and remind them what they want to do, or ask them like in the dream, you know, practice this task, work on this problem, then they could kind of get an assignment in the dream and you could have them change that dream. And then you could study what happens after that, you know, with them having been assigned a task in real time. Does that make sense?
Mm.
But there's a lot of other applications too.
So skeptics of this might say, well, you know, it's hard to interpret, you know, 18% of the recipients got the right answers and so on. A true test of this might be that you give someone the answer to a question that they couldn't possibly know while they're in deep REM sleep. But that's, I presume you can tell when someone is in REM, right?
Right, yeah.
So is that something that you tried, giving them answers that they wouldn't know when they were awake?
Yeah, so that's an interesting kind of question. You know, there's a whole literature on sleep learning also, like what can people learn while they're sleeping? You know, people used to play tape recorders to people who are sleeping, and they're like, oh, they learned to have better self-confidence. And then when that kind of got studied more, they realized that those people were learning while they were waking up, and like if you actually put EEG on them, they didn't really learn. And so then for a while it was like debunked, oh, you can't learn while you sleep. And now they're people are finding out that that's actually not true, that you actually can learn certain things while you're sleeping. You can learn these really basic sound patterns, or you can learn like associations. And so our study takes kind of a big step from that and says like, you can learn the question that was presented to you while you sleep, right? Like, so, you know, we presented 8 minus 6 to somebody, and then they woke up and they remembered that we had presented 8 minus 6. And so like, they couldn't have known that if they weren't aware of it. So like reporting what happened afterwards is kind of additional evidence that like they were communicating and it wasn't by chance, because they remembered what happened and they remembered answering. But you also bring up a good point that it would be cool to give people even harder problems or answers to things. We thought about like trying to teach people limericks in their dreams. We haven't done all this yet, but yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's true that there is a remarkable amount of information in our brain that we don't access. And I suppose when we think of dreams, we think of the subconscious. Is it possible that we might be able to explore the brain in a way that we haven't before to understand consciousness better as a result of what you've done?
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I hope for, it is that we could use it to kind of, like, one way is just to apply tests of consciousness that have been done to people who are awake to dreamers and like ask them questions about that in the way that a normal psychology experiment is done. Now you could do it on somebody who's dreaming, but like also just experientially, like lucid dreamers, you know, it's an amazing way to explore your own consciousness, because when you're awake and you think of these abstract things, they just stay in that thought space. But like when you're in a dream, everything, you know, it becomes perceptual, right? So you could go into your lucid dream and say like, show me, you know, true love, show me my deepest fear, show me something I should know, or show me what my subconscious looks like. And your dream can like play out that scenario in front of you. And so like, I think it really is an amazing way to look at, you know, something that's produced directly by your subconscious. It's interesting how in a dream you can open a door and not know what's going to be behind that door. And then, you know, your subconscious created that dream scene. So I think there's interesting possibilities there.
Yeah, I saw some journalists described it as something not dissimilar to the first, you know, first phone call, that we're not sure where science like this might lead us. But it's really exciting to talk about. Karen Conkley, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Are you a lucid dreamer? Can you control your dreams? Does this surprise you? You can email us, science@newstalk.com. We'll get to some of your stories next week. Now it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's program. And we were talking about, you know, is it possible to repopulate the entire planet from just two people? I made a sort of a joking reference to Adam and Eve. And Pat said, of course, Adam and Eve's story is true. Where do you think Trump supporters came from? Thanks, Pat. And Liam O. Griffin says, listening away to News Talk Science podcast while on a spinning bike, and Jonathan McRae reads out my tweet from last week's episode about magnetic poles flipping. I nearly fell off the bike. It's the simple things. Well, glad I gave you some sort of enjoyment, Liam O. I hope you're not on the bike now. And another person says, I drive top-end American couples and families around Ireland. They can't believe the quality of food in Ireland, even having traveled Europe first. And they cannot believe that it arrives hot to the table, not to mention the service. Well, however irrelevant to the podcast, that's good to hear. Thanks very much for that. That's it from us for this week's podcast. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, the rest of the team, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, Steve Daunt, Steve McClune was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed on Tuesday, where we'll be talking about the refractory period. In other words, why it takes so long for men to go again. Should be fun. In the meantime, stay curious.